Hi everyone. This episode is a continuation of the topic asking, does changing countries affect your identity? It is part of a series that deals with the question of whether or not our identity affects our spirituality. I encourage you to listen to the previous three episodes to get a better understanding of how this topic has evolved. And in this particular episode, I'm going to be speaking to Ubuhle Bezwe Siwane. She is a healer and an artist who works predominantly in the medium of performance and installations. She was raised in Johannesburg, and due to the nomadic nature of her upbringing, she has lived in the Eastern Cape and in KwaZulu-Natal. And she now lives and works between Amsterdam and Cape Town.
Not just to focus on the work, but as a Black South African woman, and how you navigate the world because you're a Black South African woman. What's strange for me that I actually don't know where this conversation is going to go. Generally, I have kind of an idea of how something is going to go, but and because of that, it's actually making me nervous. It's strange, but I think it's because I am not within my comfort zone, you know. I'm having a conversation that I personally haven't necessarily dealt with myself. So I'm actually have a lot to learn from what you're going to say, and not just what I personally experienced. So now that we got that second part out of the way, Okay. Let's start first things first.
Okay.
Where do you live now?
I've lived in Amsterdam for the past 4.5 years. But last year, I was between Amsterdam, Paris, and South Africa. And home, but the concept of home has also changed for me.
Yeah.
Especially since I got divorced as well. So the concept of home is no longer, you know, all of those added to what I thought home was, and I think it's become more fluid, organic, and something that's more open than it was before. And I think I've let go of the idea of home being South Africa so much, but home being where my ancestors are, or being where I am. You know what I mean? When I say where I am, it's like within me. Home is housed inside me. I'm homing myself in that way. So the geopolitics of all of that don't really resonate deeply with me anymore.
Really?
It's complex. And I think it's complex in the sense that when your ancestors give you a job, the job is far-reaching. You can't expect yourself to stay in one place. Home has to be a constant. Home is earth. But home isn't earth either. Home is where they are. So, you know, there's this liminal space where you keep negotiating what home is. Mm. And so I'm constantly rehoming myself. So if physically, but I have a home, and my home is where my ancestors reside. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But physically, a home where I am now is Amsterdam. Yeah. Okay. So that okay. is simplifying that, that... it.
Oh, it's brilliant, because you've already mentioned a lot of things that I know that we're going to get deeper into. But why did you leave?
Why I left? So I had a residency that I got invited to, and the residency was at a let me try and see if there's a South African equivalent. Let's say there was an art center at Weskopies.
Okay. Yeah. A prison.
But Siyabona is in Ngqondo.
All right. Oh, yes. Weskopies is the... Yes. Okay. Yes, yes, yes. I'm thinking of something else. Yes.
No. Like, you know, so there were lots of like some psychiatric patients, etc., outpatients, but also ones that were in prison, etc. So mm-hmm. there's an art center there, and there's an art residency that I got invited to for maybe 4 months. Mm-hmm. And because of that, then my ex-husband got invited to, well, basically applied for a job in the same, in the Netherlands as well. And
okay. Is he South African, by the way?
No.
Okay. All right.
But he is African. He was. Okay. Yeah. But that's old news now. I said,
okay.
Yes. But, so I applied for this job and got the job consequently, which I knew. But this job was spurned by me going there. And so when he got that job, I also moved. So we got relocated permanently. So that's why I ended up moving. And then after we got divorced, I met my partner in Paris, and my partner is an EU citizen. So now, you know, who complex?
I'm sure. In leaving, is it something that you've always imagined you would do? Leaving the country or being a resident in another country?
Not a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Not a chance. You couldn't have paid me to leave.
Really?
You couldn't have. And in fact, when we left, I was also, I was pretty sure that I was going to come back at some stage, because I kept on asking, how long are we going to be here? So it was not something where I thought we would be there for as long as, we eventually were. And I think the reason why I say that is the EU likes to feign ignorance about Black bodies and what Black bodies have been through, and they like to feign ignorance about their role in the massacre of forms of Black spiritualisms, and how they basically oppressed Black spiritualisms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of Black spiritualisms are cloaked under a Christian umbrella. We can also go with the Negro spirituals, you know, all of these. They have a base, and we are the base, and we, you know, this is the root. So I didn't think that this would be somewhere where I would be for this long, but I have been.
How was your first impressions of the place?
A lot of people will say it's beautiful. I will say that it is traumatic. And the reason I say that is because the city itself, city architecture speaks. And you know, there's a reason why they say Cape Dutch architecture. So as much as people think that it's beautiful, for me, it's reminiscent of a time. And that time isn't something that's beautiful for my people.
Mm. Because their history is also our history in a way.
Exactly. Exactly.
And they are compelled to celebrate it.
Exactly. But I'll go back to this where I say they feign ignorance. You know, I went to go, I went, so I give a crit to at an art school here. Mm-hmm. And the second time I presented a talk, and one of the questions I asked was, do you guys know who Jan van Riebeck is? Nothing. Not even the teachers.
What? I'm
like 40-year-olds, I'm talking about. Yes, they don't know who that is. And I said, you know, our history books, they always started off with Jan van Riebeck arrived or discovered in 1652 or 1653. And they were like, oh, really? And I was like, yeah. So, and the average Dutch person doesn't know Jan van Riebeck. But it's such a major part of our history, right? So that's why I say there's an ignorance, and ignorance is bliss. Yeah. So that's why they see it as something beautiful. Where for me, it's like, no.
Sure. That's intense, because to imagine someone who we've made to believe started our history, and for them, it's not even a thought to them. Is such a harsh thing to come to terms with, because we would think that they would be more aware of what they have done, especially the subsequent damage that has been done. But in terms of like day to day, what is the day to day of being in Amsterdam's like?
Day to day, I wake up in the morning, siyathokoza, siyavuka, siyaphahla, siyakhuluma nabadala. And you thank your lucky stars that it's not gray.
Really?
And if it is, it's just the usual get the show on the road. An average day for me is I get up, I do my work, and between that, it's just me and my it's my son, and it's my partner looking after my son, and if he's not going to work, then I am, and then it's ngiyaphahla futhi. So that's just the regular, and once in a while I'll get a message like I did from you. Either I have to speak about spirituality, or I have to discuss something or sort something out, or I have a consultation. And it's also difficult when you are on the other side of the world and you have a matwasa.
What?
Yeah. So that's also another, you know, there's a lot that has to be done.
Okay. Let's get into that. Your bio says you were born in Joburg.
Yes.
Where?
Baragwana.
Otswa Soweto.
Yebo.
Ah. Oh, okay. Okay, that gives some context into the following question. Do you believe that you were grazed within a deeply cultural context?
Sure.
Whereby isiko was paramount, and there were practices and there were rituals, and there was a lifestyle built around spirituality and culture.
Yes and no.
Okay.
The reason why it's yes and no is because growing up in Soweto, I don't know, where did you grow up? Soweto?
Close by. It's Komhlakeng, which is what, 20 minutes from there?
Okay, well, oh, Ekasi. The reason why is yes and no is because, you know, every Sunday my grandmother would go to church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a culture on its own. The culture of our grandmothers going to church, it comes with its own things. At the same time, my father lived in Port Elizabeth in the Eastern Cape. Okay. Well, now Berger. So either once a year or twice a year, I would have to spend like 2 months there. And mm-hmm. it's around the time when, you know, sometimes it would be December, sometimes it would be June. And in June and December, there's always umsebenzi.
Yeah.
There's, you know, there are things that happen as a njengamaXhosa. So I saw a lot of things happen, and we were in a space where when you come home, we have shanti, you do certain things. But then I went back to Soweto, and Soweto, I think the most that they did was uchisimbebo. Mm. And then you go to church. So that was it. It was church. But like I said, the church, especially Black churches, are cloaked. Are a cloak. There's a veil. But once we lift the veil, you can actually start seeing Guti. These things are very much centered as well in our own cultural practices.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the yes and no comes in. I think it's intrinsic, it's inherent. We cannot run away from it, even if you try. Siyakwazi ukushweleza sithi okay, ngicela nje ukuthi ubeke kancane or sifihle. And I think generally when someone says ngivala ngesonto, that's probably what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you cannot run away from certain things. It is there. It's, and when it comes up, izokusokolisa and izokusokolisa kabuhlungu.
Ne?
Yeah, kabuhlungu.
So I generally speak to, on the podcast, I speak to a lot of healers, I speak to a lot of isangoma, but I generally don't ask them about their process of the background of them becoming healers, because I don't think it's a thing to talk about. But I think in this instance, I would actually like to speak about it, because it sort of speaks to the sense of identity and identity shifts,
mm-hmm.
right? So was the process of you becoming Sangoma, was it a natural process within your family, or was it something that was not familiar to you?
Oh, so obscure.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I had never seen Sangoma, okay?
Yeah.
There had never been isangoma at my house. But the way that things were happening for me and the things that I was seeing, I was seeing people and things I'd never seen before, and I would have to explain it. I was like, you isangoma. And then I told my mom out of nowhere, ngifuna ukubona isangoma. And I kept on asking her for a month, I'm pretty sure.
Which year was this, roundabout?
I was 19, so wait, no, I get it, was 19, I was 18.
Okay.
And it was, I was about to turn 19. I kept on asking her, I need to see Sagoma. My mom was probably just like, no, because it's like weird. And also, where does she find Sagoma? Mm. So it was almost like I was just leading her down this like, path and this road which she was just, and I think it's uncomfortable for her, because it's just, my mother likes being in control of things, and when she doesn't, she likes being a hero. So when she can't hero it out or save or something like that, it's like hi, yay. So we got to this point where I eventually got into an accident, and there was no explanation whatsoever for the accident happening at all. In fact, it should never have happened, and no one could find an explanation. They tried to say that, was this person drinking? Was this? And everybody was just like, no, none of that. And it was also a miracle that nobody was hurt. So at that point, my mother, the next day, she took me to see Sangoma.
Wow.
The very next day. And then she explained what had happened, and she explained what I had asked for, which was the fact that I needed to see someone. And the guy was like, yeah, because she's got a calling. And then he asked me what I saw in my dreams, and I explained to him, and he was like, these are classic signs. I mean, how is it not? And
you're
like,
you are going in now.
I mean, that's exactly what they would have liked. But, you know, you're in university, you're doing your first year. Was it my first or second year? Yeah, one of those. And are you really going to, it was my second year, are you really going to, long for your class and I'm better in my second year. Let me go. But at the end of the day, by I think the middle of my second year, I was gone.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that was my first foray into TWASA.
Did it change how you viewed yourself?
Completely. It changed how I viewed myself. It changed how I viewed other people. It changed how I also you know, when you decide, I think the word escapes me now, when you I mean, going out to parties wasn't the same, it changed who I was as a human being. I wasn't like, I think there's a point where somebody complained and was like, hey, how's that pull me, you know? And I'm like, I'm like, that's not me anymore. It wasn't me. And I needed time to, you know, it's almost like, you need to say goodbye. They ask you to say goodbye to the person that you are. And I think you have to really, because when you come out, it is no longer you. Your priorities are not the same. You need to listen differently. And you're also working with people, and people are sensitive, and the people's spirits are sensitive. And if you want to work with people, you have to dial down the noise. In order to hear the spirit of a person.
A lot of the time we perceive spirituality as being deeply rooted in our context and in our geography. Now you had to move. How was the move? Because you've explained it from a practicality point of view and work-wise, but how was the move spiritually? How did you come to sort of come to terms with the fact that I have to move, and as a spiritual person, it's not the same as just upping and leaving and finding another job?
That's a really simple question to answer, and I'll answer it in one sentence. I'm still trying to grapple with that.
Right. Yeah.
It's not an easy thing, because there's a way that you're taught to work. But what I've realized is there's multiple ways to work. There's multiple ways to pack up and practice. And that's where the homing and rehoming comes in, homing yourself spiritually. And that's why I say that my spirit, where my spirit is at home, is where I'm home. So spirits nendumba, and it's where we practice, where we speak, and where we do all of these things. But when people travel, they can make themselves a mini station. Unfortunately,
border control.
I have been fortunate enough to never, whenever I have like a whole lot. In fact, I probably
had houses. Did you smuggle it?
Yeah, I did. What was I supposed to do, honestly? I had probably a whole suitcase full, and half a suitcase full. and let us suitcase F. And you know, for me, as long as I have that, as long as I have makhandlela, even if incense namahia, I think it's fine. You know, you station yourself the way that you want to station yourself, as long as you know that you communicate, you haven't cut communication with your ancestors. That's the most important thing. And you still do the job. Mina, my job is to make work about my spiritual, the spiritual journey, and to reach people in that way using umsebenzi wam. So as long as I'm doing that, I'm doing my job. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing what they've called me for. If I was not doing that, then having a different conversation.
Mm.
Yeah. Then I'd be saying something different.
When a lot of the time when people buy a Twasa or when they come out, there's, for some people, there's this conflict between this is what I wanted to do and yet this is what I'm being asked to do.
Right.
Or more specifically, this is what I'm good at and now I'm being asked to do this thing. Did you ever have that kind of conflict where what you believed were your true talents conflicting with your spiritual assignment?
No.
Mm-hmm.
My ancestors have been very clear and I've been very clear about what it is that I wanted to do. We've been on the same page from get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's the thing, right? You need to be clear. And amadlozi abantu, they were once people. Siyaphumisana. Sithi ogogo ngicela into eso. You don't just because they say you do this, etc. And sometimes you might not see the bigger picture too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's always a bigger picture. Sometimes I'm like, oh man, this and this and this, and then there's a bigger picture.
When you were here, what did the work of it is of being a Sangoma entail when you were still here, or rather when you are here in South Africa?
I think the same thing that it does now, except that, you know, I can't just slaughter a chicken. Right? You know, I still need to think about those things.
Are they goats that side?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, there's rules. There's rules here. Tina, Emakaya, I sign, I send some Jesse Funai. It just depends where you are, honestly. Like, if I was in Spain, the south of Spain, or rural France, or whatever, mm-hmm. that would be okay. You know, possibly that might work, but in the city, not so much. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, where you are is Amsterdam is obviously a city.
Yeah.
Okay. And your gift and the reason you travel and your work are literally the same thing.
That's how I see it. That's how I see it. Yes. Obviously, I'm also there to umsebenzi wabantu. I need to art and art making is also umsebenzi wabantu, but you reach in a different way. But umsebenzi wezandla zabantu, ukusebenzisa abantu, ukunyanga abantu ngezandla, I do that as well. Ngiyahamba ngiyogeza abantu, ngifutshisa abantu, I do all of that stuff.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, I do that.
How do you find clients?
I don't. They find me and I get recommended. I really don't. Oh. You know, there was a time when I was like, I think yes, Kati, when I came out of Electrosin, I was, I think it was quiet for a week. And then all of a sudden, people started showing up. And then I got here and then people just started emailing me.
Mm.
So, it shifts.
You mentioned that Unamatwas.
Yeah.
How does that work?
So I was actually home not so long ago to try and finish up some things in order to move things along for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it works in the sense that I'm still also trying to figure it out before, and I've been running away from it for quite a while.
Really? Keep running away?
Yeah, I mean, Amatwasa, it's such a big job. You're responsible for someone.
Mm.
Yeah, and I felt like, at the time I didn't even have a child. So now I have an actual 50% DNA me. So I'm like, you know what? There's no running away from some things. You just got to get in there and you have to work around it. What I do not like is that, you know, Lamatwasa, you always have to work on also people's timelines, because people have timelines of their own. I don't have time for timelines. Me is going to be my timeline.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does it cause conflict?
It does. And it causes internal conflict, my own internal conflict. And it causes conflict with the people that say that they need me, because then they're only able to get a hold of me like on WhatsApp and email, etc. And that can be a little bit difficult and a little bit frustrating. But I flew home. I wasn't home not so long ago to do some stuff. I was down to work on the Standard Bank Young Artist Award. And then I was also,
congratulations for that, by the way.
Thank you. And then I was also down for Amatwasa, but we had to halt that a little bit, not because I didn't have time, but also because the idea of home again and space is something that has to be negotiated. Indumbayam isemasabasi. Yeah. And the space is not big enough for... So I want it to be... And it's my grandmother's house. So I want to be able to do certain things in the freedom of... So also Namatwasa Awaz Uba free.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a huge debate right now within... I suppose Ubungoma around technology and to what extent technology can facilitate spirituality, and whether how I almost want to say how authentic it is, because I think I remember they were saying that there was a lady who was sort of facilitating Tata through TikTok videos. And giving instructions to people on essentially how to self-initiate, how to do it without...
That's very dangerous.
And I suppose that's the debate. And I would imagine that, have you come across people who said that what you're doing is not authentic, being a gorilla who lives in a different country while Amatwasa in a different country?
No, not yet. But if I do, then I will tell them that it's Beginda Bazako. Yeah, but at the same time, now that you brought this TikTok, I mean, obviously what I'm doing is not close to this TikTok situation.
Yeah.
No, and I don't think it's the same. I would never leave Itwasa ngimtshele ukuthi, okay, faka lokhu nalokhu, yenza kaso, kaso, kaso. No, isandla sakho fanele ukuthi sibe khona.
Yeah.
Yes, idlozi lithi yenza kaso. Nalapho fanele ukuthi ubheke ukuthi idlozi linjani. So, yeah, I mean, but that's the thing about technology. It has its pitfalls, but it also has... ways in which it can help. I'm not condoning, I don't necessarily condone a lot of ubamba umoya ngephone noma ubamba umoya ngeemail. And the reason why I say that is I always feel like it's better to have the person right in front of you. There's nothing better for me than to look a person right in the eye. Go back, lapo. I will know immediately what is happening as opposed to now I must fetch get phone. I find it not difficult but more emotionally taxing. So I don't think that technology is an impediment. I just think that it can be a little bit, it's always better face to face, in person. And I mean, all of these things had to be thought about during COVID as well, because we had
true.
To
work. True. Yeah. Okay. Now I want to talk a bit more about the identity thing, right? So, as I've mentioned to you before, part of what it is that I'm trying to understand is how we engage with identity outside of South Africa, because me being a Black South African automatically means that I am perpetually disadvantaged by the whole system. Being a Black South African, the identity of a Black South African does actually mean that I am lesser than something, because there's a whole system built around me that makes sure that I can't function optimally as a person. There'll always be hurdles in front of me and around me, and me as a Black man, right? So now when you are a Black South African woman who's living outside of that system, what is it that being a South African mean when you don't have those impediments? Do you feel a sense of freedom where you are? Do you feel a sense of not being crushed by the system? And I think you another question that I wanted to ask you about when I was asking about the day to day was, you know, as Black people, we're very guarded around white people, because we inherently know that no matter who they are, we're always judging them. We have to keep them at a distance. Do you find that that's also true when you are in another country? But firstly, do you feel that you are outside of the South African system as a person when you're in Amsterdam?
No, I think I'm shackled by my own mind and by my own society and all the things that I've learned in my environment. And also the world never lets me forget that I'm Black and I'm a Black woman and I'm also from South Africa, because it's always, the question is always, where are you from? Where are you from?
Mm-hmm. So, why the second from?
Because you'll say, oh, I'm from Amsterdam. I live in Amsterdam. Which is true. I'm coming from Amsterdam. No, where are you from? Why is it? And then you can still ask a person who speaks Dutch, who is Black, the same question. Even though their family has been here for 3 or 4 generations, you're still going to ask them, where are you from? Because you can never just be Black, wherever you are. But then, you know, being South African and Black is also, it's compounded by the fact that we have been taught to think about ourselves in very specific ways. And what I've been trying to do is unlearn a whole lot of stuff. And one of those things is, I'm learning how not to be scared anymore. And I've been on this journey for a while. Because one of the things that they do to you as a Black person, number one, is instill such a fear in you of a lot of things. Just, you know, it's almost like you should be afraid to live. And then secondly, as a Black female South African, then there's another fear, my gender, my sexual identity, there's so much that's happening. My body becomes a play, you know, so all of these things are just compounded. And then I get here and I remember I was in Zurich. Actually, this is a perfect example. I was in Zurich and there's a street, Langstrasse. And I was walking on the street at night. I was going to a club, probably it was 2016. And this man stops me and he's like, how much? But he wasn't the first one. There were quite a few that night. And the idea is that if you're black on the street, you must be a prostitute. And so this is not, it wasn't the last time that it happened to me in the EU. It's happened quite a few times. And there's nothing in you that says, you're not dressed in any particular kind of way, because we know that, you know, as a South African woman, if you dress this way, yes, who are you asking for it? Blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
So, no, I was fully dressed. I was just being afraid from all of the noise that's happening in my head. And then I allowed that space to get to a point, I allowed it to get to a point where I got shackled again by my own mind. So I think that our mind, I allow myself to shackle myself in these places, because if people make these assumptions, the onus is on me as well to say people can make the assumptions. So what? I'm not now anymore. Mm. You know, those are people's assumptions. And I've also gotten to the place where I think I'm okay with whatever people think. I'm just like, oh, this is what you think. Okay. But I'll buzanga. Okay. Sharp. Mm. So, you know, that's that. To answer your first question, does that answer your first question?
It does. It does. It does. And I think saying that, when you say that, we basically carry our shackles in our mind is intense, because is intense, because it means that I will always feel under threat no matter where I am. You know, even when there actually isn't a threat around, I will perceive that it is a threat. And now I'm asking myself, what happens when you don't have that? Like, is it even possible to be a Black South African person living abroad and you don't have those shackles? And what would it, like, I'm literally just thinking out loud, like, how would it even look like? What would that experience be like? And I'll give you an example. Like, you know, you go online and you see sometimes these very beautiful pictures of these cabins in the woods, you know, by a lake, and you're like, yeah, it would be beautiful. Then you're like, Black South African, bruh, no, I am not living in the woods for nothing. I am not doing that too much. Like, you just know. Nah, you know what I mean? You're already having, or you have this. I saw someone posted a picture of a house in the woods there, where it was the bathroom was just, the bathroom walls were just glass, and you're just looking into the forest, and you're like, no, as you know, like, as a Black woman, no, we're not bathing outside, you know. And for me, it genuinely feels like almost impossible that for you to let go of that, those fears. It almost implies that you let go of being South African, because that's what literally it means to be South African, to perpetually live in fear of the world.
Yeah, I think, yes and no, I see your point, but I think we're getting dangerously close to say that our identity is based on fear, and that's scary.
Mm-hmm,
also.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just like, my identity is based off of this, me fearing A, B, and C. And it's, in a way, it's poetic, and in a way, it's just like, oh my God, there's so much truth to that statement, but it can't be. I can't let that be the case, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so sad. But then, you know, the reason why I also say that I'm shackled by my mind is because I remember also I had like a late dinner, and then I went to some event, and I then walked around the city at night. I'm sure I was walking around. So this place where I had dinner closed at like 1 a.m. And then I think, I don't know what I did, but we did something with some friends. And then at 4 o'clock, I decided to take the bus home.
Mm-hmm.
4 a.m.
Yeah.
Alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you see, that's not a weird thing to do here. But, you need to think about it now, because as a South African, everybody always asks you, you know, it was so weird being here and nobody's like, text me when you get home. No one says that, because you're gonna get home.
Like, why wouldn't you get home?
Exactly. You see, it's like, it's completely normal for you to go, and it's a normal thing. You should be at home, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but here we are. Text me when you get home. Oh my God. No, guys, it's literally...
Travel in groups. Don't go to the bathroom alone.
Yes, because next thing you're just afraid. But see, even the child who has a stroke, and then the next thing...
She was six.
You see what I mean? What kind of world is this that we live in that like a child can't even go to the toilet?
At a public restaurant.
Yes, this is the fear.
Speaking of which, how does being there affect your approach to parenting?
I know that I'm not the only one parenting. I know that my ancestors are parenting through me. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say that is because you're saying that, you know, I'm a child, I'm so happy.
Yeah.
So, when I was pregnant, I was like, what type of a thing is this to have your first child at 35, guys? Parenting over here, that's the question.
Yeah, like how, okay, let me sort of give more context. You know how you raised the case of the child who was raped in the bathroom. We are very paranoid, especially for girl children. We're very paranoid about safety. And we're less, especially as this generation, we're very not trusting. We don't trust very well with other people with our kids. That's on the one hand, right? There's the issue of trust. And then on the other hand, we're dealing with the idea of language. Our kids, are we handing over language properly? Are we teaching them culture, isigo? Are we, you know, are we good custodians of the handover process?
Right.
So in those two contexts, like how is being in Amsterdam impacting that?
So first of all, like I said, I know that my ancestors are parenting through me, are using me to parent, because my child is not mine, it's their child, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's a child that they gave to me. But also, my child is also one parent is from the Caribbean, and, you know, I'm South African, so there's a whole mixture of cultures, ideas, etc. as well in that one child. So I know that the only thing that my child has to survive is me.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Wow. My child has to survive me. That's it. I'm not really worried about all these other things. My biggest worry is... my child being a black boy, I think the world, no matter where you are, is very aggressive towards black boys, specifically, when they're growing up. So I just want my son to be in a perpetual state of black boy joy.
Mm.
So if I can, I will just make sure that he is happy as much as possible, because when I finally lend him to the world, that he is settled enough in himself to be able to be strong in his foundation wherever he goes. So the job is not only mine, but my ancestors and his father. I hope that makes sense. So it's not about...
No, it does.
Okay. So I'm not necessarily... It could be wherever he is. I know that in South Africa, angakhina kakhulu, but la, there's a tendency to also start not liking yourself because you're black and not liking your people.
Really?
I think very different parts of Europe raise different types of black men.
Wow.
Yeah. And the one that I am trying to raise is one who is stealth in himself and knows, well, man, yeah, yes, which is super important.
So certain parts make for harder black men and certain parts make for, I suppose, softer black men. Is that what you say?
Part of it, yes. Softer, harder, ones who do not necessarily, you know, I think even at home, there's versions of us who don't like ourselves by virtue of being black. Mm-hmm. Because of what that represents and historically what that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough to grapple with. And it's tough to grapple with yourself when it appears that the world does not like you.
Sure. I want to go back to something that you mentioned right at the beginning about how you had to let go of the idea, the concept of home, and how you home is you. Is that something that you've always had growing up? Because, you know, there are people who grow up very self-contained, you know. Mm-hmm. they feel genuine and they don't feel connected. They don't feel that they need to be connected to it, but they feel that they are connected within themselves. Mm-hmm. Was that the process of turning yourself or embracing yourself as home? Was it a difficult process?
Yes, it has been a difficult process. But it's been a process of heavy reflection. A heavy reflection in the sense that I needed to be, to say, Buhle, this is the reality of your life and these are the things that you have to do. So that ukwazi sisi ukwenza izinto othufuna uzenza nezinto othufuna uzenza for idlozi nabantwana bedlozi nabantwana bakho umzimba benyama. So those are the things. Yeah, it's been, the idea of home has also been an internal battle, but I finally got to a resolution and one day it clicked to me that the idea of home that I had was so linear, so limiting. And home doesn't have to be something that's limiting and in a box. It's something that can be open, fluid, organic. And I think that's why there's people who chase the sun. I now understand that thing. Like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I understand people who have a caravan and they just sell their house. I understand all of that because it's not, you know, it's almost like saying, "Uti idlozi material possession."
Yeah.
And it can reach you anywhere as long as you keep an open line of communication. So me, my open line of communication is my home. Where idlozi finds me, ngisekhaya.
Mm.
Yeah.
We believe a lot as black people that, you know, a big part of our identity is rooted in community. We are very communal by nature. How do you set up, or how do you cultivate community, or how have you cultivated community or that sense of belonging when you're in Amsterdam?
I never forget where I'm from, number one. And also there's a whole crew of South Africans that I like to hang out with. Okay. So we also kind of found each other here, and tried to hang out with each other. quite often. But since I've become a parent, that's been happening less because a lot of them don't have children.
Yeah.
So, and that happens, I think, you know.
It happens with every, it happens. Yeah, no, your circle definitely goes smaller once you have a child.
Yeah, and it's not due to you. I think that people are kind of like afraid to ask you to go out or whatever. But obviously.
Yeah, because you have bedtime now. There's bedtime routine.
You really do. What's so hard? I don't understand. Guys, I think it's all the time. But you see, that's another thing. I was never like that anyway. Because there are days where I'm just like, yo, so, yeah. But community for me has always been about who I make work for and who I make work about. And this is why my work is so important to me. It's not about me only, it's about the communities that I come from, the communities that have raised me, the histories of the communities that I am dissecting and excavating. So my work is basically only about our social political stances as communities of Black people. Yes. As Ibango must teta andori, so I'm always trying to excavate those histories that aren't spoken about, or communities that are kind of just, or a sense, I'm excavating a sense of community. But it's almost like we've always been collective as a people.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's true. Just that we've been split. I think there's a lot of things that have split us, and they came in many forms. The onus is upon us to try and find each other again.
You've exhibited your work at many different places around the world. Do you find that the location impacts on the reception of the work?
No, people always find it difficult to understand my work.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But there'll always be like a few people who will be like, oh my God. Because I think that it's difficult to see yourself in something and to see the reality of what has happened to people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially when it's something which you don't necessarily understand. So it's easy to understand Christianity, but when you want to speak about, like, you know, ubungoma, alapi.
Because I saw images. I saw images of I think it was 2021 work in Zunza where you were in France, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, so I get then where you're saying that it seems inaccessible to those people because they don't have that context for it.
And also the language. So that's where language is important.
Because all your work is in cause.
Yeah, there's only one work that I did that was in English. Yeah. And it was it last year? It was last year.
Why is that? Why did you decide that while you are, even though you are exhibiting in front of non-Xhosa speaking people, but to keep it to that language?
What French person will name their work in English?
Right.
So my language, why must it not? My language is as important to me.
Does the accessibility ever worry you that I think I need to make the work more accessible?
Never. It's not a problem. It's never going to worry me. I'm steadfast in that. Never. I feel the same way about, you know, white people who have been in South Africa for years. You grow up there. How do you grow up there and you don't know a single vernacular language? Uziva njani wena ungakwazi ukuthetha nabantu ngolwimi lwabo? Hayi, sisengxakini.
And you say you're an African.
That's my big thing. Me, so when you can't speak that, I'm automatically like, ah, settler.
Wow. Okay. Towards a cop.
Toggles.
Out of all the things that set human beings apart from other creatures in the world, one of the most outstanding ones has to be our ability to create stories. From the earliest memories of ancient life, the image of people gathered around a fire under a vast night sky is an image that somehow we can all relate to. Even though we have not been there all those tens of thousands of years ago, we can vividly imagine what was happening as that fire illuminated eager faces and young eyes wide with wonder. There is something about stories that seems to be woven into the very fabric of our DNA. It is through stories that we try to make sense of our world. Back then, we looked at the moon and its soft gradations of gray, and we saw a man, we saw a woman, we saw a mythical creature, an epic tale about love and loss, about triumph and defeat, about hope and despair. There isn't a mountain, a river, an ocean, a rock, or flower, or animal, or insect that does not have some kind of story told by some kind of people somewhere to share information that will guide, warn, teach, or entertain. But our stories aren't just about myths and fantastical worlds of a bygone era told by primitive villages under the gaze of the stars. We also have stories in our so-called modern times that, for all intents and purposes, appear as facts. For me, one of the most astonishing stories ever told by a modern man is the tale of the supposed value of gold. Apart from the few pieces of technology that can utilize this metal, gold is actually violently useless in comparison to it, the stature that it holds. The value of gold is in reality just as mythical as the dragons of House Targaryen, or even the powerful web woven by the Nigerian Akan god of stories, Anansi. Yet today, gold forms the very basis of the entire modern world's capitalistic economic system. A system in which lives a god so powerful that every man, woman, and child of every race, religion, and creed on this planet bows down to money. Scientists may push out paper after paper rubbishing people's beliefs in spirits and gods, but every scientist believes with every fiber of their being in money and the weekend, both of which are figments of the human imagination. The value of gold, and by extension the worth of the global economic system, is a story that many more people believe in than any other story, but it is still just a story nonetheless. For most of us, it is stories about ourselves that we hold dearest. Our names were birthed out of stories that our people have told for hundreds of years. Our surnames, even though they are recent inventions, they carry a significance that almost validates our very existence. For us, as Black people, we hold our stories with a particular kind of fragility because we have witnessed just how drastically our individual and collective stories can change. The conversations that I've had in the last few episodes have had a profound impact on my understanding of what identity is. Throughout my thinking life, I have always believed that identity is something that is solid and unchanging, that the story of who I am is set in stone, and so are the stories of others around me and of the world itself. But as our languages change, as our cultures shift, and as the world becomes increasingly focused on profits, convenience, and distraction, the ground on which our sense of identity is built on is becoming less firm. But there is an even bigger elephant in the room from which this whole series started from, and that is, does identity affect a person's spirituality? Where I stand now, the answer to this question essentially hinges on how you answer another question, and that is, does spirituality evolve? By evolution, I mean, for an example, there are fundamental principles such as physics and mathematics and biology that governed our world since existence began. But life itself has evolved. The Earth has seen a multitude of life forms appear and change and adapt and die and disappear. Human beings themselves make a minuscule single-digit percentage of what has existed before on this planet. I will assume that in the spiritual realm, there are also fundamental principles that govern how that world functions. But has life in the spiritual realm itself evolved over time? Yes, in all likelihood, in the spiritual realm, time does not exist, but I think you understand where I'm going with this. So in answering this question, if we say that spirituality does not evolve, and the entities in the spiritual realm, the ones that we as human beings engage with, have not changed since existence began, then the answer for me is that your identity has no bearing on spirituality. In this sense, there's no need for rituals, there's no need for the use of language, there's no need for practices of any kind, and there is no need of any kind of belief. Why? Because if spirituality has existed in the exact same way since billions of years before human beings existed, then nothing that human beings do has any effect on it. But if we say that spirituality does evolve and has evolved, if we talk about Mundao as a spirit whose existence is linked to the advent of human beings, or is a spirit that has existed before man but evolved in order to meet the metaphysical needs of human spirituality, if we say that Inzunza is an entity maybe from a different realm but has adapted in some form or another in order to connect with human beings, if the spiritual realm is just as immensely populated and dynamic as this plane of existence, then yes, identity does affect spirituality. But not only that, but it would also necessarily mean that as we, as human beings, as people, as the world, as we change, then that aspect of spirituality that engages with us is also changing. It changes as our sense of self changes. As we travel to foreign lands and distant places, as our individual and collective stories go through all manner of historical triumphs and traumas, as we find and lose ourselves over and over again, that which we call spirit is also undulating with those changes, twisting to changing eras and epochs, inspiring new practices and adapting to new languages that have not yet known a tongue to call home. And if that is the case, then spirituality will always and forever be an intrinsic part of human existence. Whether or not we will always know how to access or engage with it is a question that we will most likely only be able to answer in hindsight. I really want to thank Buhlebezwe Siwane and Lerato Shadi and Banele Reu and Koko Kanyagute and Koko Mahlodi for this particular series, and all the other amazing and insightful guests that I've had so far who have laid a foundation that has allowed me and you to be able to dig up such complex issues. I don't know why this sounds like an end of a season, but it's not. I guess this topic was much heavier than I had anticipated it to be, but yeah. My name is Wasum Zinglande. Thank you so very much for joining me on yet another episode of The Journey Kwantu. I appreciate you taking your time to listen, and I appreciate all the feedback and I appreciate all the questions and all the suggestions for new topics. I would appreciate if you shared your thoughts as well on this particular episode and any other episode you would like to know more about. I wish you light, I wish you courage, and I wish you all the very best on your journey. Makwande.